The summer of 2020 is awfully slow for the music biz, but thanks to the internet, WebEx, and Zoom, there are musicians and recitals in our living room. Welcome to Spectrum West, where Western Wisconsin talks about and listens to the ways we entertain and take care of ourselves, the voice of the arts and culture in this fertile part of the state. This week, John McCutcheon is here with details behind his new album, Cabin Fever, Songs from the Quarantine, and we'll sample a couple tracks. Jim Oliver found a recently published book by Wisconsin author Sarah Carlson. He read it, and today he and author discuss the background behind Everything's Not Fine, a Wisconsin-based novel. And we begin here. Yasmin has been a Spectrum West guest a few times. Her music is fresh and vibrant, and her approach to writing music has been one of inclusion and profusion, a cornucopia of people and places. 2019's transition to 2020, however, has been different. Her travels and collaborations have been reduced to a trickle for reasons man-made and pandemic-made. This Sunday is Father's Day, and to honor hers, T. Bruce Bowers, she's written a song. The official release date is Sunday, but you're going to get a sneak preview today. And then Sunday, you'll be able to buy the song online, with a portion going to a very worthy charitable organization. We spoke with Yasmin from her Washburn, Wisconsin location earlier this week. The last time you and I talked was July of 2018. We talked about your then new album, Nautilus, an album about love. Today we're going to be playing a song that's about a different kind of love, not one that sparks between two people and then goes through changes and either goes on or goes away. This is the love that's there the moment you're born, and even though experiences and closeness might ebb and flow, the love sticks around. The term unconditional has been applied to the family kind. This has been an exceedingly noteworthy time in your life, both as a musician, because of course the pandemic has made an impact on so many musical lives, and as a daughter. Before we get to the song that you are so kind to share, let's talk about, and this is poetic the way it sounds, let's talk about the Yasmin quarantine. What has that been like?
Yeah, wow. Well, it started personally quite a while before the global quarantine. So my dad, T. Bruce Bowers, he was fighting cancer for quite a few years, but over the last year, starting last August, his health declined. It pretty much was 6 months. You know, I would work some, and my mom did some work too, but it was kind of this getting closer and closer, and as we did, it became that we were at home with family and not leaving the house much, starting probably back in December, and then my dad passed in March. The day that he died, which was March 19th, was actually the day that they first discovered a COVID-19 case in our county. Our quarantine ended, and another one began, and we just went straight into that.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was a bit surreal, I have to say. Pretty challenging in some ways, but people were just so loving and supportive in the ways that they could be from afar. We were lifted up. We were buoyed during that time, and so much love, yeah.
No, it's wonderful you had the time to spend.
Yeah, and in a way, you know, we felt really grateful to have that pause in our lives at that moment, because sometimes it's too hard to go back out into the world right away and have to go to work. And so we had a little breath. And as an artist and as an introverted artist, I do love just being at home and working on my art.
Well,
you know, it's not that way for everyone, and we were lucky to be in that position.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your new song, which we're going to play. The new song, Going Home, And I thank you for sharing what is still probably a tough time of reflection and gathering perspective. The last time you and I talked, back in that aforementioned July of 2018, your dad's name came up. Let's go back then. I don't know that we talked about this, what being the daughter of T. Bruce Bowers was like as a young girl. Tell me about your vantage point. Did you have the luxury of standing off stage and watching all the stuff and Big Top and all that cool stuff?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was a child of Big Top, and that was a great experience growing up behind the scenes and being part of the shows from early on. And yeah, always watching my dad, and he had such an amazing presence on stage. I think that that was the thing that anyone who shared the stage with him would say, and had a way of just lighting things up. And yeah, he was a firecracker, you know. That was just who he was. And on and off stage, I would say.
Can you remember yourself being there, thinking to yourself, yeah, I'm going to do that?
Yeah, I mean, it was always a part of what I did. That's what we did together since I was, you know, born practically.
Oh,
and
cool.
So it was never even a thought. It kind of just happened. But I think that there was a point in my teens that I decided that it was going to be my career focus, and that I would try to make a go of it. You know, the daughter of two professional musicians, my mom, Hope McLeod, was also a singer-songwriter for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the struggles of what that life entailed. So I think it was kind of the behind-the-scenes look was good, that I knew what I was getting into.
There you go. Singer-songwriter Yasmin with us on the telephone from Washburn, Wisconsin. She has written a Father's Day gift for all of us and for herself. It's a song called Going Home. We'll be playing it in a bit. I have never liked applying the term the late to a person's name. The late John Prine, the late Pete Seeger, the late Bruce Bowers, especially if that person was always on time. If your dad was a musical influence, and I take it he was, what is Yasmin of tomorrow going to be like? You wrote this song. Do you sense others that are going to come from the perspective of his and our mortality?
Yeah, I think he's a part of me, and that will never change. I think it will unfold in new ways, and I'm excited to see what the next chapter is. I think that so much is changing, not only for myself personally, but in our world right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is this opportunity for rebirth and rebuilding of something better. So I want to focus on that and grow that wherever it may go.
I was just on the phone previously to this interview with John McCutcheon, the singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
And I didn't get to it because he and I ran out of time. But I wanted to, and maybe I'll get to it with you, but I guess I don't know your reputation about writing music that is conscious of our social surroundings.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember some of the songs that I've heard you sing, not just pandemic. That predicament and what's going on now with the continued racial intolerance, that kind of stuff, is that the stuff of Yasmin tunes?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I've written a few songs in the past that touch on issues like that.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one that I'm planning to re-release on my next album called Working in the Shadows, that was about an immigrant friend that I knew and the struggles that he went through. Things like that, I feel like we have to talk about them. And it's a little, it's scary. It's very, I always worry about wanting to speak from the heart, but also say something meaningful and that's not harmful. So I think sometimes it's hard to write those songs, but I definitely feel that they need to be said.
Okay.
And I don't know. I don't know what's coming for me in the next wave of inspiration, but that's definitely a part of it.
Uh-huh. Your dad, of course, instrumentalist extraordinaire, and he had the ability to bring people together to play music. Did he write? And if what kind of stuff did he write?
You know, he was he did write. Okay. He did, but I think he came at it much more from the instrumentalist perspective.
Okay.
So he would come up with these beautiful melodies and harmonies and structure, and then a lot of times it would be really hard. He tried to write lyrics a few times and was successful, but I think it was a much more of a struggle for him.
Uh-huh.
So we tended to actually collaborate in that way quite a bit, where he would write a melody and I would ask, oh, can I put words to that? And so that was really fun.
Cool. Has he appeared on your recordings? I guess so. Huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's on all of them.
Good.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So, pandemic-wise, affected your schedule? Shows postponed, canceled?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yes, definitely. I had a pretty full summer season on the books, and one by one, they've kind of been dropping or changing. Some have switched to streaming online,
sure.
Which I like. It's a nice format.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be doing some more of those later in the summer. Yeah, I I've had to make the hard decision to cancel a few as well, just because of my mom has a lung condition, and I just can't take any risks with exposing her to things.
I hear you.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
Back to the social consciousness. I meant to bring it up, but it went flying off into the space. You're sitting up in Washburn, Wisconsin. You're kind of isolated from it. Does it feel like you're a million miles away from the action, or does it give you a really nice vantage point?
Yes and no. Well, I lived in St. Paul for like 3.5 years,
uh-huh.
And so I feel very connected there, and there's a lot of people I'm thinking about and I've been reaching out to. So in that sense, I do feel kind of far away. Like I wish I was there, you know, at the time of things getting really heated up. I wanted to be there and couldn't. But I would say on a social consciousness level, our area is really stepping up. And people have gone out. There's been 3 protests now in the area. I went to 2 of them. It's been just really beautiful amount of change and waking up, hopefully making some lasting changes even here, because you know, that same system exists here, you know, in the Native American population. It's the same thing, and that needs to change.
Yeah. And instead of the smell of tear gas, the smell of patchouli.
Yes. Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Thank you for sharing this moment and this song, which is just around the corner. I have a feeling Going Home is going to become an anthem of sorts for grieving daughters and sons.
Can I say one last thing? I'm partnering with the Dave Gallup Foundation for the proceeds of this. So half of the proceeds from any sale of this song on my website, yasminmusic.com, will go to the Dave Gallup Foundation, which is a safe environment for people in recovery from drugs and alcohol. A friend of mine, very close friend from the Menominee Nation, he spoke to me right before my father passed, and he reminded me, in his Native American tradition, they don't say someone is dying, they say they're going home.
Oh,
and so
there you go.
That touched me very deeply, and was a huge part of my inspiration. So he works as part of this foundation, and I just felt that that was where I wanted to send some support.
Marvelous, marvelous association. And the website again is yasminmusic.com. That's YAZMIN. Chin up. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you.
We come and go like the falling leaves. We come and go like the birds and trees. We say a prayer for the ones we love. We leave our fear to the skies above. You're going home. You're going home, you're going home now, you're going home. You lived your life like a burning sun. Watch it shine like hell till the burning's done. You gave me love and you gave me fire. Now I take it all and hope it brings me higher. You're going home. You're going home. You're going home now. You're going home. Oh, and you made mistakes that have shaped my world. But I forgive them and I will make them pearls. We said the word. Did we learn the lessons like we knew we should? We have a tale that is long and old. So I know I'll see you down this winding road. Going home, you're going home.
Again, come Sunday, you can purchase the song and honor your father or anyone, knowing that half the affordable amount goes to people helping other people lift themselves up. Yasmeen and Going Home. The new music of John McCutcheon later on, and next, Jim Oliver phones a Wisconsin author about a new book on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, offering the fully redesigned RAV4 with all-wheel drive and new safety features. Located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at MarquardtToyota.com. Wisconsin author, Wisconsin setting. Just the kind of book Jim Oliver enjoys. The author is Sarah Carlson. The book, Everything's Not Fine. The man, Jim Oliver.
When did you start actually writing?
Well, I've actually, ever since I was very young, been a very creative person. My mom tells stories about before I was even in school that I would kind of create like these elaborate imaginary worlds around myself with complex stories and characters and setting and all that stuff. And I really enjoy kind of living and playing in those imaginary worlds. went through elementary school. In fourth grade, actually, there was this writing competition in my school district, and my writing was selected to go to this kind of district convention, and my short story was put in this bound book with all these other kids' short stories. I was just like, wow, that is my story. It's out there, it's printed, and people are reading it. And it was just such an exciting experience, and it just kind of increased my love of storytelling. And then as I grew older, I just continued thinking of stories and writing them down. And, you know, when I was in middle school, before we had a computer, I was writing hundreds of pages of loose leaf paper, stories that were inspired by books by Stephen King, things like that. And then as I progressed through high school and college, I just kept writing. I always found stories to tell, characters that kind of existed in my head and wanted to put them on the page and bring them in the world. And for the longest time, it was just something that I did for fun. The bigger things that I was writing, I didn't even show anybody. I just wrote it because it was fun to use writing as a way to explore things beyond my experiences. So I have a long history of just loving to write and loving to create stories that starts back from a very young age.
When did you start working on Everything's Not Fine?
2014, when I was actually living in Singapore with my husband. His job took us over there, and I took a pause from working as a school psychologist. I had a lot more time on my hands to really get serious about writing and dig more into querying literary agents and kind of building my social media presence, working kind of with other writing groups to kind of push my writing craft forward and to kind of continue to build on my skills. So Singapore was this point in my life where I had the space, both kind of time and also just like the mental space to really kind of dig in and explore writing more seriously. So yeah, so it was quite a number of years that I was working on it with kind of life interrupting, I guess you could say, my creative process, but good things.
Why don't you give us the Cliff Notes version of this, how the story gets started?
One of the things that I love to do in my stories is I love to have connections to Wisconsin in my stories if they're not set in Wisconsin. The story is about a teenage girl whose mother is addicted to heroin, and she and her family kind of just ignore it as best they can and just kind of try to go about their lives until the teenager Rose comes home and finds her mom in the throes of a heroin overdose. So the story is really about kind of how that singular traumatic event, Rose's life, the main character, and the family's world just kind of shatters it. And the story is about kind of exploring how Rose helps to pick up the pieces for both her family, but also for herself, and how she develops her own narrative, her own understanding of what her mother's choices mean for her as she tries to figure out what to do with her future.
We are talking to Sarah Carlson, who is the author of Everything's Not Fine. Somewhere in the book, you talk about how you mine the experts in the field for information. How did that work for you?
Well, so in part, I drew from some of my own experiences as a school psychologist, some of the training that I've had. Trauma and parental substance abuse. Obviously, nothing in the story is drawn from any student or family that I've worked with, but the elements of what it's like to go through a traumatic event and some of the things that I've learned around helping kids get through traumatic events. But in particular, one of the things that I did after I wrote the story, I solicited feedback from a person who lived that story, whose parent was addicted to heroin, to help to ensure that I was capturing the experience in an authentic way, or at the very least, capturing in a way that does no harm to people who have experienced that. I also worked with some social workers capturing what happens after something like that in terms of child protective services and how they get involved so that I could explore that too. And I did a lot of other kinds of research as well, the nature of addiction, how it kind of takes hold and what the progression looks like too, to kind of capture the experience so that, you know, if there's children who are going through that they can identify with some of the struggles that Rose goes through, the way that she's torn between, you know, loving her mother, but also hating her mother's choices and trying to make sense of that dichotomy that can't be resolved until her mother hopefully someday finds a way to be clean.
In your comments in the book somewhere, anyway, you said something about a rather substantial percentage of school kids have to deal with family problems involving mm-hmm. drugs. And I notice every so often there's a picture of some person, some parent in the paper who's been arrested for exposing their children to mm-hmm. marijuana or meth or mm-hmm. whatever. Back in my day, I don't remember that being such an issue days. What brought this on anyway?
Well, in particular for the opioid crisis, part of it stemmed, I think it was in the mid to late 90s, a new kind of painkiller was developed, you know, based on opioids. And there were certain pharmaceutical companies that were really pushing it, selling it to doctors like, hey, this is like a miracle painkiller. You know, they were telling doctors it wasn't addictive. And I think that they were pushing pretty hard, you know, to get doctors to prescribe it. There was a rapid increase in how much these opioids like Vicodin, Oxycontin were being legitimately given to people who were suffering from pain. While these people were being told, like, oh, well, it's not addictive. It actually is addictive, in particular for people who might be suffering some kind of emotional pain in addition to physical pain. They have the effect of numbing physical pain, but also numbing, you know, some of the emotional pain that people might be suffering from. And so what happened was some people became addicted to the prescription drug. And then, you know, eventually, as the medical community realized the addictive nature of these drugs, they started scaling back and being much more cautious, for the most part, in how much they were prescribing it. And then you have people who are addicted to these substances, and then they discover, like, they'll try other ways to get the prescription, and then they might try to buy the prescription illegally. But then heroin is actually much cheaper in a lot of places and offers a more powerful high. It started in not all cases, but in a lot of cases, it started out, it was a prescription for a legitimate pain that became an addiction. And then there wasn't necessarily, you know, at least initially, the understanding of kind of that trajectory and how to stop it. And then it led to some people exploring other ways to get that pain medication, because when they initially started, you know, it wasn't something that they had realized it would be an outcome. Mm-hmm. So,
getting back to your position as a school psychologist in an elementary school, how much are you enabled to work with the families when a student is in a situation like we've been talking about? What do you do?
It kind of depends on the situation, like how I found out and kind of the family's willingness to have their kid work with someone such as myself, because obviously I need parent permission to work with any kid on an ongoing basis. And honestly, I did kind of put some of the stuff that I, as a professional, when I'm working with kids whose parents might be struggling with substance abuse, or if there's just other life stressors that are going on or adverse childhood experiences that they're going through, I actually drew from my personal experience and kind of the approaches that I take and put it in the book. There's a guidance counselor in the book whose name is Mrs. O'Neill. So a lot of the things that she says to Rose are stuff that I might say to a student that I was working with, depending on their age. And it's a lot of recognizing the role that they have. They don't have any control over a lot of that stuff, even though it's tearing their lives apart, and really trying to focus on helping them to find outlets to let out that pain rather than keeping it trapped inside, whether it's finding people they know that they can trust to talk about it, finding, you know, using art, physical activity, things like that as a healthy outlet. And then also just recognizing it's okay sometimes to just do your darndest to put it in a box and put it on the shelf, put those worries in an imaginary box and shelve it so that you're not constantly carrying that burden with you. And in the school setting as well, actually, I do groups for kids who've been exposed to trauma that focuses on helping them to develop healthy thinking patterns and healthy coping strategies. That's something that I've done kind of at the elementary and the middle school level, and I have done that with kids who have had parents that are struggling with substance abuse.
Well, we've been talking to Sarah Carlson, who is author of Everything's Not Fine, published by Turner Publishing. The book, her second novel, was released at the end of May, and it's available through the publisher and also from Barnes & Noble, Amazon, other online booksellers. And I suspect if you went to your favorite local bookstore, they might order it for you if they don't have it in stock. Sarah Carlson, thanks so much for being with us. I hope the book goes well for you.
Thanks for having me. It was a great experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim Oliver. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, offering the mobile app that provides access 24/7 to view balances, pay bills, and more. Available on iPhone, iPad, and Android. More is at charterbank.bank. Hey, here's a Spectrum memo for you. Good news, Chippewa Valley Museum is open. They have new health and safety procedures, and they have new summer hours. It's a gradual reopening. You can visit their website. They have limited summer hours, Tuesdays from 5 to 8, Wednesday to Sunday from 12 to 5. The website is cvmuseum.com. John McCutcheon is one of Wisconsin's favorite musical sons.
I was a shut-in like everyone else. No work and no school and no bars. My official insistence, we each kept our distance as I went for a walk in the park. Just me and my hound, two souls on a leash, cooped at home day after day. As homeward we steered, it was there she appeared, and I fell in love 6 feet away. Two people, two yards to have, not to hold, she held me complete in her sway. I wanted so much, but forbidden to touch, so I loved her from 6 feet away. Eyes met, I nodded, she nods in return. My tongue froze, I'd nothing to say. At that beautiful face, I stared across that space, and I loved her from 6 feet away.
Yes, that's John McCutcheon. Having grown up in Wausau, Wisconsin, has since made a worldwide name for himself as a songwriter of distinction and instrumental talent and a singing voice that's unmistakable. He now lives just outside Atlanta, Georgia, and we spoke by phone the other day about a bunch of current stuff, like his new album called Cabin Fever, Songs from the Quarantine. You and I have talked a couple times, March of 2015. The last time was March of 2017. At the time, I asked you about the pressure of being a prolific songwriter, and if you're trying to shake that moniker, well, this new album is not going to help, because you obviously have been busy writing stuff. The evolution of your music. So another 3 years has passed. There can be some evolution in 3 years. Has there been some for you since we last talked?
Well, I think so. I took some songwriting time out from the public standpoint, because 17, I'm trying to remember, were we talking about Trolling for Dreams or Ghostlight?
It sounds like Trolling, albums. I think, is the...
Yeah. I mean, I had previously done an album of Joe Hill songs that came out in 2015 because it was the 100th anniversary of his death. Mm-hmm. I mean, backing up even further, 2012, I put out an album of Woody Guthrie songs because 2012, of course, was his 100th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And he figured so largely into my early musical education. I mean, I went down to the Marathon County Public Library, and the only book that they had there that had guitar chords in it, or that the Dewey Decimal System had listed as guitar, was a book called Woody Guthrie Folk Songs.
Yep.
2012, it was Woody's 100th. 2019,
yes.
I worked on it in 18, was the 100th anniversary of Pete Seeger's birth. So Trolling for Dreams came about because I got sick, and I had to stay home for 3 months. Does that sound familiar?
Uh-huh. Sure does.
And it exists because I have the luxury of every day going to that file that every writer I know has and luxuriating over it, songs in various states of incompletion.
Sure.
So I got to finish a whole bunch of songs that were languishing in there. And the result of that was Trolling for Dreams. The following spring, I left a songwriting camp that I run 3 times a year at the Highlander Center in East Tennessee.
Yes.
And I challenged all the people who asked the obvious question at the end, well, okay, we've been, you know, surrounded by other songwriters here for 5 days, eating, breathing, sleeping, songwriting. And now we're going home by ourselves, back to our families and our homes, and we're not going to have that kind of inspiration around us. Can you give us some ideas of how to keep the muse amused?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, this coming Monday is the 25th anniversary of my friend Bedran Smilovic, the cellist of Sarajevo, mm-hmm. beginning his 22-day vigil in the midst of the Balkan War, where he played cello every day in front of a bakery that had been bombed. And he played 22 days because that was the number of people that were killed in the bombing.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, this is a remarkable thing. This was a musical vigil. This was answering ugliness with beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we try to do in this world. So this coming Monday, here's an assignment. Every day for 22 days, sit down and write. And if you're not writing for yourself, write in Smilovic's honor. And the day came, and I thought, well, geez, maybe I ought to do my own exercise. And I wrote every day for actually about 30 days. And the album Ghostlight, which came out on the heels of Trolling for Dreams, was the result. But I kept on writing, but I took a break because all of a sudden, the Seeger album came along. So I came back from Australia mid-March. I'm getting to something here.
Okay. I'm waiting.
I came back from Australia in mid-March, and I come home, and I've got an album of songs ready to go, songs that I have written since Ghostlight came out, but that were shelved in favor of the Seeger album.
This is March of this year?
Of this year.
Okay.
I've been holding these songs back, and I have studio time booked. My usual crew of musicians all set to go.
Yeah.
And I came back, and lo and behold, it's clear nobody's going into a little airless room with 4 other people
mm-hmm.
anytime soon.
And there's reasons to write new music.
Yeah, well, I came back, and I went into self-quarantine because I just gotten off a 24-hour plane ride. And, you know, I'm playing at these big festivals with thousands of people in a tent. And these really friendly Australians coming up afterwards and throwing their arm around my shoulder and said, let's take a selfie. So I figured if I wasn't infected, I was vaccinated. But by the time I came home, you know, my diabetic wife and my 89-year-old mother-in-law who lives with us shouldn't have to pay the price.
Wow.
My wife, who's also a writer, and I have a little cabin in the North Georgia mountains, and I just went up there for 3 weeks and wrote. Among other things, but that mm-hmm. was my job.
And health-wise, everything came out fine.
Yeah, yeah, good. Amazingly enough.
Since you brought up the Century Club and Pete Seeger, had he made it another 5 years, would have turned 100, and you celebrated with several friends in a stirring rendition of How Can I Keep From Singing with a Buddhist singing bowl as accompaniment. The video of that looks like it took a lot of work. In fact, it looks almost quarantine-ish. That might have been a warm-up for you.
It could have been. This was done by my friend John Vesner, part of the Don Juans. They play with Tom Paxson these days.
Okay.
He happens to be Kathy Mattea's husband, and I met him through Kathy. And one of the things he likes to do is videos. And I came up with this idea of doing something with How Can I Keep From Singing. The two of us contacted a variety of our different friends.
Yeah, it was neat. All black and white, and Kathy was in it, I saw, and just a whole bunch of people.
Oh, yeah.
And thank you for putting the credits afterward, because some I did not recognize. But it's pretty cool. I suggest people go watch that. It's a very moving rendition. And I thought, you know, gee, was that song on your radar for a special occasion? Then I went back and found an album called A Retrospective, where John McCutcheon has a rather full head of dark hair. And, and there was the song. So it's been on the playlist for a while.
Interestingly enough, that came off my very first album, 1974-75. But the version that we did the video of came off what at that time was my most recent album, the aforementioned tribute to Pete Seeger. And had I not used up that wonderful title for the title of my first album, it would have been a very logical title for the Seeger collection.
On the phone with John McCutcheon. He has a new album. It's called Cabin Fever. It's wonderful and it's fun at the same time. Songs from the quarantine at this stage of my life and yours, John. We've been through some monumental times and events with the rest of America. I didn't think, and maybe you didn't think, about a pandemic. Not one that could touch us all, and all meaning the world, of course. Voila, Cabin Fever. I'll bet you simply couldn't help yourself. You just had to write during this thing.
Well, you know, how can I keep him writing?
There you go.
It's my job, you know, and I started doing it when I was just a kid living in and outside of Wausau. And I wrote lots of really terrible songs back then. But I still write terrible songs, I suppose, but I have the good sense and the experience to know what not to put out there.
There you go.
But my evolution as a songwriter over the years is actually kind of a full circle back to the kind of bare bones storytelling style that I learned from banging out those first few chords from that Woody Guthrie songbook. Here was a guy who wrote about everything, wrote kids' songs and love songs and historical songs and topical songs. And if you look at my body of work, well, I guess the lesson took. But my style has really developed into I'd like to think, leaner style that focuses on storytelling and letting someone's voice speak the story. I'm not a guy who sings my diary, as has been described of some writers. So, you know, when I wanted to think about how I want to tell the story of anonymity and depersonalization has to be a prerequisite for people going to war. Suddenly it's, my name is Francis Tolliver. I come from Liverpool.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell you my story. Uh-huh. I'm not going to tell you what to think. I'm just going to lay my story out there, and you're smart, you're thoughtful. Take it and run with it. See what you think. And so some of the stuff on Cabin Fever is reflecting upon the vagaries of the time, from the goofy 6 feet away, which was the product of a conversation with my wife when I said, what would it be like if we had met today? You know,
yeah.
And we had to maintain this distance, and I couldn't see half your face and all that kind of stuff.
It's a wonderful waltz. I call it a love song for quarantine-agers.
Kind of the opposite of that is, you know, Monet Refuses the Operation, inspired by a poem of the same name that I read in the Paris Review. You know, when I get in that groove, virtually everything is fodder for songs. Conversations with friends, several of these things came from conversations with friends, phone, or just taking a sideways look as well. What being sheltered in place, what does that mean? And aren't there people in our world that are kind of permanently sheltered in place?
I mean, this is an amazing CD. I mean, it has 18 tracks on it, folks, so that's reason enough to buy the dang thing. So you're writing, and you're sheltered in place the way the rest of us are, and there's even a song called Sheltered in Place. And then, suddenly, you went, oops, I have another song I got to put on there, The Night That John Prine Died. What a neat song. You know, John Prine. I mean, many songwriters aspired to write like that, and then they just gave up trying. It was
too damn simple.
Yeah.
Any fool can be complicated.
And it was after listening to that song over the weekend, I said, you know, I love John Prine, I have his music, but I needed to look in even further. And then I discovered the love, friendship, warm thing he had with Steve Goodman, another songwriter who nobody could top. And then I watched an old video of those two guys singing Souvenirs on stage and smiling at each other. And then I relived the whole Steve Goodman story. So what a weekend it was. So thanks to the CD for bringing up a lot of stuff for me.
Oh, I'm grateful that I was able to know John well enough to write the song. John was one of those guys that his death caught people by surprise. I mean, I knew he was sick. I knew that he'd had serious health issues. And if anybody that I knew was susceptible, it was John. So I frankly wasn't surprised. Though what did surprise me, and I think what surprised a lot of people, is how moved they were when they heard that news. Just imagining a world in which there isn't that kind of wry, tender, goofy perspective. I mean, is there a better line than there's a hole in daddy's arm where all the money goes?
Yeah.
I mean, kids walking around in someone else's clothes. It says so much with so little. It really is the kind of economy of language and expansion of the heart that every writer wants to do. I said, John, do you have more than three melodies that you use? He said, I have three?
In these times, each day feels like the next. But just tonight, my old friend Richard sent a tearful text. I could feel his sorrow on the screen, wondering if I'd heard the news tonight that John Prine died. He seemed to pluck his songs out of thin air. They told of tiny triumphs and lives filled with despair. Complex in their simplicity, so honest and so true. Just what every writer wished that they could do. There's an angel from Montgomery that's finally taken wing, and a place up there called Paradise where even Sam Stone sings. All the losers, lovers, loners have gathered round the throne in a mighty choir to welcome John Prine home. I remember a night, a bar in Cambridge town. The band took a break, we took the stage and shut the whole place down. It was Stevie Goodman's birthday, just 8 years since he died. We sang, drank, and remembered. We laughed and then we cried. Just like tonight when I heard the John Prine died. There's an angel from Montgomery that's finally taken wing. A place up there called Paradise where even Sam Stone sings. All the losers, lovers, loners have gathered round the throne in a mighty choir to welcome John Prine home. How to sit here thinking about the stories we tell and the blessed few who really do make heaven out of hell. So say hello to Stevie, I ain't ready for you yet. In the meantime, I know you'll enjoy that 9 Mile cigarette. There's an angel from Montgomery that's finally taken wing, and a place up there called Paradise where even Sam Stone sings. All the losers, lovers, loners gathered round the throne in a mighty choir to welcome John Prine home. All the loser lovers, loners have gathered round the throne. In a mighty choir to welcome John Prine.
Come back when you can come back to Wisconsin and entertain us. And thanks for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. And please keep in touch.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. It's always great to be back home, even if it is just virtually.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
The album is Cabin Fever, Songs from the Quarantine. The incomparable, in my estimation, John McCutcheon. Hey, have you heard about Operation Picnic from the Feed My People Food Bank? You can double your impact between now and the end of June. Feed kids all summer with weekend kids' meals. Support delivery and food distribution in 14 West Central Wisconsin counties. Can provide food to pop-up pantries in Eau Claire and rural communities, including Augusta, Cadott, Oliva, Strum, Fairchild, and Fall Creek. Can go to give.fmpfoodbank.org/operationpicnic. Do it. You'll feel good. A special note, the legacy of one who teaches a love of music and one who works to preserve it for future generations, well, that legacy is strong and secure, as is the legacy of Ron Keezer. We mourn his passing, but celebrate his good life. And Diz Cronenberg, always the good sport right up to the end, the kind of role model young people simply must have. Who will step up and fill the void? It'll take a few of us. What a fun show this has been. A privilege to be with you guys. Thanks for being in the audience. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Catherine, and Jim. Live safe and smart. Let's get together again.